Since they won't let the majority of the people who are in out, we need to go knocking on the doors. No, we need to go knocking on the doors. We have to argue for a relationship, for communications between the free world and the unfree world.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and that was Angela Davis, part of Alternative Radio. And we were playing that instead of Paul Muse's usual News from Neptune show. Paul is out of town this weekend, so we were playing that. So stay tuned for the Illinois World Labor Hour. Dave Johnson and the whole collective crew is here today, so stay tuned for a great show here.
We're not a working. Hello, folks, and welcome to the February 11th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming, those of the speaker, do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed or underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. It's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week is one from his book, Cries for Justice, and is entitled Who Remembers Orwell? Also here with us today are co-hosts Pat Simpson, Bill Gorell, and Bob Pelesny. So now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
The Champaign City Council last Tuesday night voted to begin collecting 4 cents per gallon of gas sold in Champaign starting in May, claiming the money will start to chip away at some $60 million worth of desperately needed road improvements in the Champaign area. The new tax had both its advocates and detractors, but a slim 5-4 majority of council members ultimately decided that our city streets need a lot of repairs, and soon. Tom Bruno was the first council member to begin circulating a petition to get the discussion of the 4-cent tax underway last year. Officials are expecting the new revenues to total about $1.5 million per year, all of which will be required by law to pay for transportation improvements. Bruno also referred to the ordinance as a jobs bill because it would give work to local laborers and local paving companies. Bruno's comment on the ordinance was, "This is building our roads and our highways for our children and our grandchildren."
I just want to comment. I believe Tom Bruno is a Republican. Even though I know that the local politics is like that is nonpartisan races, and you know, it's surprising to hear him talking about raising a tax. But oh, I forgot, it's a sales tax, so it's regressive.
Yes,
so they love it.
Thanks, Bill. I got a story here. Since December 18th, a couple dozen retirees of Century Aluminum Plant in Ravenswood, West Virginia, have occupied a median along Route 33. They call their encampment Occupy Century Aluminum and say they've taken this action to fight a company that has kicked hundreds of retired employees off of health care. After shuttering the West Virginia smelter in early 2009, Century Aluminum began terminating health benefits for retirees in June of 2010. After nearly 2 years of trying to get the company's attention, the retirees found inspiration in the 99% movement. Karen Gorell, at 62, is the youngest resident of the Occupy Century Aluminum. What they say is, "We are the approximately 500 families who, after working for many years at the Ravenswood Works under various aluminum company names, who met the contractual requirements to retire with lifetime insurance and prescription benefits, each based on the contract benefits that were in effect at the time of retirement. The executives at Century Aluminum Company unilaterally made the decision to modify these contractual obligations by terminating these benefits to increase their profit margins and apparently to reward themselves with larger bonuses. This resulted in not only wiping out insurance and prescription benefits, but also a large portion, if not all, of the retiree pensions due to having to spend their pension money on insurance or try to survive without coverage. What the workers say, the retirees say, is this is an example of corporate greed at its very worst.
Protesters upset by Indiana's passage of right-to-work legislation showed up with signs during NBC's Today show broadcast from downtown Indianapolis' Super Bowl Village last Sunday. The Indianapolis Star and WISH-TV report that dozens of protesters holding or wearing protest signs mixed with NFL fans as Al Roker and Ann Curry reported live Friday morning from the village. The protesters tried to position themselves within the camera shot during the broadcast. Governor Mitch Daniels on Wednesday signed a bill passed by the legislature that makes Indiana the 23rd state to ban labor contracts that require workers to pay union representation fees. National AFL-CIO leaders announced Wednesday they did not support any attempts to disrupt the Super Bowl, calling it America's game. But union members have vowed to continue to fight Indiana's new right-to-work law. Very discouraging. Anyway, Tom, I mean about the National AFL-CIO not mobilizing.
Hey, the State Farm Insurance Company has announced it will be hiring more than 3,000 people across the United States and Canada, filling many positions vacated during the recession and adding 900 agents. The news followed an announcement by the Chrysler Corporation that it will be adding almost 2,000 at a plant in northern Illinois, adding to evidence that the national economy is continuing to pick up steam, as cited by the Associated Press. The Bloomington, Illinois-based State Farm office announced it is accepting applications for the 3,000 available jobs, which will be mainly in customer service, claims, and information technology. State Farm Insurance currently has a workforce of 65,000 employees besides its 17,800 agents, and the addition of the Illinois jobs will boost employees' numbers by some 4.6%.
Thanks, Tom. I got a story here, two stories actually, about Caterpillar. Caterpillar announced Friday it would close its London, Ontario locomotive plant after 465 workers there refused to grant concessions that would cut their wages in half. Workers had been locked out since January 1st, and Caterpillar did not try to use cabs. The closure was expected by the Canadian auto workers, as Caterpillar has been blatant in its intent to whipsaw the well-paid workers in London against low-paid workers in a non-union plant it recently purchased in Muncie, Indiana. Union picketers will maintain their 24-hour blockade of a mostly finished locomotive that is sitting on a spur line east of London until our members are taken care of, said Local 27 Vice President Jim Reed. CAW Local 27 President Tim Carey predicts that Caterpillar would try to lowball workers on severance, unemployment benefits, and pensions. He said the local was prepared to occupy the plant if Caterpillar doesn't offer workers a decent severance package. And also locally this week, Caterpillar has ruled out Illinois as a site for a factory and 1,400 jobs it plans to move from Japan, but potentially puts it in North Carolina. Caterpillar laid out its decision Tuesday in an email to elected leaders in Peoria County. The company cited logistical problems with building the plant in its home state and continuing concerns about the business climate here.
Okay, attorneys representing the city of Chicago told a federal judge Thursday they have reached a settlement with nearly 700 people detained by police during a 2003 anti-war protest. The city has agreed to pay members of the class action lawsuit a total of $6.2 million. Attorneys representing the city of Chicago told a federal judge Thursday they have reached a settlement with nearly 700 people detained by police during a 2003 anti-war protest, and the city has agreed to pay members of the class action lawsuit a total of $6.2 million. I hope it sends a message that they need to treat us like citizens and not combat, said Cheryl Angeliso, one of the protesters arrested near Chicago and Michigan Avenues a day after the start of the Iraq War in March of 2003. The settlement has drawn extra attention ahead of the G8 and NATO meetings scheduled for Chicago this May. The event is expected to draw world leaders as well as demonstrators. Attorneys for the protesters say their lawsuit sends a message that police must allow demonstrators to exercise their constitutional rights and notify the crowd before mass arrest begins. Lawyers representing Chicago, the city of Chicago, declined to immediately comment.
Yeah, Dave, with all the live streaming and such and YouTubing and such going on from recent protests all over the United States, it will be interesting to see what happens at the G8 with the Illinois law, by the way, which was passed by Democrats and signed by a Democratic governor that makes it illegal. I think it might even be a felony to videotape police officers.
Well, it's got to be defied. I mean, they can pass all the laws they want, but, you know, if they can't enforce them, I mean, just like in the before the 1930s, I mean, they used to use courts, injunctions, and, you know, jail time to try to stop labor unions from even forming, you know, and the law was defied, and it was broken, the unjust law, you know. So, but, I mean, this is definitely up in the ante, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, see, actually, Illinois had law, and I should have called Tom Hartman yesterday because he was wrong on something, but he thought it was went back to the early law, I believe it was passed in 1961, which was about mainly it was about eavesdropping, audio eavesdropping. Mm-hmm. And you might remember the incident here in Champaign with the people making the documentary.
Yes, Patrick Thompson and Martell Miller, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, actually, what it is people just have to give their consent to be audio taped.
That's it.
You see, and since those officers obviously would not give their consent to be audio taped.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's why every time you call somewhere on the phone, they have to tell you that they're going to record
right.
you, because some states like Illinois do that. You have to give your consent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're actually, I should have looked this up before I commented, but I believe there's somebody in the legislature right now that's hoping to get some kind of bill passed before the G8 mm-hmm. that allows for the videotaping of police officers doing their job in public.
Well, they're public
servants. Which should be.
They're public servants. So citizens, regular citizens, have every right to record what they're doing, especially considering the rampant police abuse that's going on around the country.
Well, here's a good one, Dave. The most rampant police abuse locally in Champaign that's been gone viral on the internet was a tape made by the police themselves on their car camera.
Yes.
And I don't know who in the police department leaked that, but thank you very much.
Yes.
I just want to make another comment about the upcoming G8 meetings. One of the issues that's also of great concern is, will protesters be confined to certain areas?
Mm-hmm.
Rahm Emanuel certainly wants to see that happening. The ACLU is protesting that kind of confinement of protest as an infringement on actual free speech. So
free
it's going to be
area, though.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We only have free speech in certain designated areas. It's sort of like smoking, I guess. And so that's going to be a big and interesting issue coming up in terms of the G8 meeting.
Okay, we'll keep you posted. And Tom, do you have a final news story?
One more story. Super Value Groceries, which has annual sales of about $37 billion, has about 135,000 employees. Its network includes 1,104 traditional retail stores, 798 in-store pharmacies, 1,309 hard discount stores, and 1,900 independent stores served by the company's traditional food distribution business. SuperValue has plans to cut some 800 positions nationwide, and SuperValue's facilities in Champaign-Urbana will be cutting 10 or fewer jobs in the local area. The SuperValue Distribution Center in Urbana and the W. Newell & Company Produce Center in Champaign together employ about 500 people. SuperValue said the reductions, expected to take place by February 25th, include both current positions and open jobs that won't be filled. The company said it hopes to reduce permanent expenses and operating costs so it can provide more competitive pricing for customers.
Okay, very good. All right, we've got a very special guest that's here in the studio, and she wanted to come in to talk about an issue that's happening here locally. So, Carol, welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour. Could you introduce yourselves for the listeners?
Yes, my name is Carol McCusick, and I've been watching change in the Urbana City Code that was passed by the City Council July 18th and went into effect that has to do with the licensing of haulers.
Garbage haulers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The intent of the legislation was to encourage businesses to recycle through asking the people who pick up their regular garbage to offer them expanded service or different deals for a separate pickup for recyclables.
Mm-hmm.
And what the city asked of the haulers was that they at least offer the same range of types of stuff or offer to pick up the admixture that the city residential program use cycle currently picks up. I'm speaking because out of my concern, which I would truly have to admit that it is kind of a theoretical concern that the recycling industry nets out positively for the environment with a look towards the future.
Mm-hmm.
I have gone down to Public Works just yesterday and the day before because I wanted to check on the forms that went out to the haulers that as a result of the change in the law July 18th to see what they actually looked like. I spoke with Courtney Rushforth, whose title is Recycling Coordinator. And she has received on-time replies from what she says they have 19, might be 20, 19 or 20 that are licensed by mm-hmm. the city. And so these companies would be trying to comply with this new law. What they've got to do is once a year they've got to go to businesses and tell them, offer them deals for the businesses don't have to take it, but mm-hmm. they have to be approached once a year by the haulers mm-hmm. under this new city law. And furthermore, they have to show that they've done that to the city.
Okay. So your concern on this change here is just you're worried about the private haulers actually complying fully with what the old Urbana services were as far as recycling?
I see this program as a bump up in mm-hmm. the a bigger thrust toward recycling, and I've learned through some questions that I gave to the environmental sustainability manager that the recycling industry, and I better just read exactly the one sentence, recycling facilities generally do not fall under regulation by IEPA, that mm-hmm. would be Illinois Environmental Protection Agency,
uh-huh.
unlike other facilities that handle waste materials. And then as far as in transit, the material would be, he says, would be under Urbana City Code and the Illinois Vehicle Code. Which include requirements that loads be secured and prevention of litter during transit.
Do you know why the City of Urbana's U-Cycle program was ended? I mean, why did they why are they trying to outsource this to private garbage haulers?
I don't know the history of their contracting for that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know they used to do it themselves. I'm sorry. I know it's been in. I would like to. This is important corollary to my concern because I think I'm concerned about recycling because it has been going on a long time,
mm-hmm.
and I think we should be sure that we have the tools to evaluate that it nets out positively. They on the theoretical basis, where mm-hmm. I would think there would be like a lot of water and chemicals,
okay.
And there would have to be some residues involved, and then that would be issues that would be in addition to the issues of the energy involved in having two pickups by a truck or running conveyor belts and things like
that. I see. Okay.
So it is.
Do you think, what do you advocate as far as citizens of Urbana do? Do you advocate that maybe they turn out to city council meetings, or is there some kind of other commission meetings in the city of Urbana that they could come out to express their concerns?
Yes. it's supposed to, I would say this is supposed to be relevant to or the work of the Sustainability Advisory Commission.
Okay.
Should be interested in this bill. I did understand that they did not give much oversight on this, but I think that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, one of the things that changed with there are some things that changed with the reporting requirements that mm-hmm. these haulers have. Not to say, well, it used to be quarterly,
mm-hmm.
and they went to annual. And they did that in the middle of the year there, and also they added other more categories of on the form that they have to declare of what they collected. They don't just have to declare the weight of the recyclables. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot, there's more to collect, but the key thing that they didn't ask for is what weights do they take to the destinations on the other end.
Okay.
So in my mind, again, mm-hmm. you know, just theoretically, is that you do not have to account for, you pick all this up and you don't have to account for what you send to the landfill at the end. So my question would be, would there be control against dumping,
mm-hmm.
you know, get like reaming out the valuable part of the load? And there's a lot of new haulers. And I'm sure that the haulers are in pretty stiff competition because they have to do this extra work to sell this
yes.
service,
mm-hmm.
but the businesses are going to have to pay more money to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And the city would like to, and I'm kind of the person standing in the way, because they didn't really succeed in getting this passed by the city council. They would like to offer a reward and recognition program to the businesses, like mm-hmm. a public relations incentive for them spending this extra money. And I'm saying, well, I think there needs to be more validation that recycling stays positive. If the haulers, a lot of new haulers, and if they are in competition, they will not want one guy to just go off and, you know, to get the advantage over the others
sure.
by not operating properly. So it may just, like, the problems may help off, you know, they may check each other, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Already, in one respect, I think they probably do check each other, because the city gave them an opportunity to declare, along with this reporting, they have to say how much weight they collect, and they have to say the destinations they take it to, but not, as I say, they don't have to account for the weight on the final end. Well, the city allows them to say, to use, they have to tell the city where they take it, the facilities they take it to. It might include something like the LRC or the landfill,
okay.
and as well as maybe third-party processors and things
okay.
like that.
Yeah, I think you know, people need to, residents of Urbana should definitely turn out to their next city council meeting and ask some of these questions. Hopefully you'll be there, Carol, and can ask some of these concerns, you know, because I think this is, definitely a potential problem here.
Yeah, I was just going to comment. I happened to see a documentary on PBS sometime about a week ago, which was essentially called something to the effect of "There is no away." And one of the points that they were making is how often it is the case that recycling programs are essentially facing these problems where haulers actually are not recycling, in fact, the various disposables that they collect, and they are putting them in landfills when they're supposed to be recycled. I also happen to have lived in New York City during the years where there was a lot of supposed toxic waste from hospitals and the like that was supposed to go to specially provided waste disposal areas that would guarantee protections against leaching, and et cetera. And instead, all of that was going into the notorious New Jersey landfills. These monitoring these programs, evaluating these programs can be a very important thing.
Okay, Carol, well, thank you so much for coming in to the Labor Hour and informing our listeners about this problem. And so, do you know when the next Urbana City Council meeting is?
They're Mondays.
Oh, they're on Mondays? Okay.
Every Monday at 7. If people work in the industry and they are aware of toxic residue problems, as I say, the city public works doesn't realizes that they are the only regulatory authority for mm-hmm. the industry and as the licensor, and they are not aware of any toxics.
Mm-hmm.
They say it's a pretty closed loop thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if people call to their number, which is 384-2452 or 2542, of the Public Works number.
Okay.
They will look into it.
Okay.
They told me that.
Okay, very good. Thank you for coming in, Carol. Okay.
I've seen you, Carol.
Yes, and so now we come to that portion of the program. The Illinois Labor Hour Cultural Corner with Tom's poem from his book, Cries for Justice, Who Remembers Orwell?
George Orwell told us a story back in 1948, predicting 1984 as a time of terrible fate. Though 84 has long gone by, his forecasts now are coming true, to a point where we need to stop and start our nation's dream anew. There's no room here for Big Brother or a language of just two words. There's no reason for working folk to be manipulated in herds. Once we had a constitution guaranteeing our human rights, promising us joy and justice and filling the darkness with lights. Your TV could be watching you, or your computer is a fact. Our constitution's lost its clout, canceled by their Patriot Act. It's time to end their peccant rule, reinstate our Constitution. It's time to lock the liars up, they need to see prosecution. It's time for truth to fill the air, for justice to be enacted. It's time each dunce in Washington from government be extracted. Who Remembers Orwell was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois in 2007 and was brought to you live today, February 11th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. This coming Tuesday, Valentine's Day, February 14th, there's going to be a rally at noon on the quad side of the Illini Union. Campus labor unions and student organizations are celebrating Valentine's Day this year with an unusual twist. We say the university has no heart and, moreover, no respect for employees who ensure the campus runs according to its mission, no respect for students who attend classes and work on campus, and no respect for laws to protect the workers and students. So join us for a noon rally on the quad on Valentine's Day, February 14th, and don't let the heart-shaped signs fool you. We're hopping mad about rising tuition and fees, loss of real wages, cuts to services and failing equipment, anti-union tactics, some of which are blatantly illegal, spying on union meetings, interference with the right to join a union, bad faith and surface bargaining, broken promises and violated agreement. and outright lies. So to get together at lunch and demand 180 degrees reversal because the reality of University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign administration is the exact opposite of the fair, open, land-grant public institution of higher learning that this community and this state deserves. So be there this Tuesday at noon on the quad right behind the Illini Union. Also, this Sunday, tune in for Labor's Worldview TV on Urbana Public Television Comcast Channel 6 with host Jim Iman and yours truly. And also to let you know, the new Public Eye has just hit the newsstands throughout Champaign-Urbana. There's some great, it's a great issue here. Stories by Sarah Lazar about end of war for whom, question mark. Former Mayor Dan McCollum has an article in there about residency in the police. Conrad Wetzel has an article about depleted uranium. And Emmanuel Goldstein has an article, Our Government Has Been Hijacked. So get the new recently published Public Eye throughout Champaign-Urbana. Okay, we're going to take a real quick musical break here, and we're going to be back with a special segment from Pat Simpson. So stay tuned.
I heard the gentlest souls. I robbed my wife and son. I turned my back on troubles, troubles I'd begun. I cut a swath of pain and loss in the hallways of my home. In the quiet of my room, I know the things I've done. Save the hammer for the man. Save the hammer for the man. It's the calling of the wretched. It's the rising of the damned. Save the hammer for the man.
I was driven from the city. In the wilderness I stand. In the cleansing rain and silence, I made my battle plan. Alone I marched towards freedom, leaving footprints across the land. With a vow that's left unspoken, save the hammer for the man. Save the hammer for the man.
Okay, that was Tom Morello's new CD, Worldwide Rebel Song, Save the Hammer for the Man. Okay, now our co-host Pat Simpson has a very special little segment she wants to present here. Pat?
Yeah, thank you, Dave. Back in the 70s, I had the privilege of being a student of the very renowned labor historian David Montgomery. And David died on December 2nd of last year at the age of 84, a total unexpected death. It was a cerebral hemorrhage. And today in Pittsburgh, there is a second memorial. There actually was one in New Haven earlier this year for David, and it particularly focuses on the faculty and as well as the students who knew him at the University of Pittsburgh. And I was one of those individuals who had the privilege of being a student of David's in those years. And I couldn't be in Pittsburgh today for a number of reasons. So I thought that it would be appropriate to do a bit of a memorial in David's honor. The reason I think David is such a special person, above and beyond his academic credentials and the many books that he produced on the subject of labor history, and we'll hear a little bit about that from the YouTube segment that we're going to play in a minute, is that he remained, despite the fact that he became such a world-renowned labor historian, he remained an activist and close to the labor movement throughout his life. And so I was asked, along with all of his students, to produce some comments about what David meant to him for a memory book that's being produced for his family. And one of the things I talked about was the fact that he was a man who never lost his connections. We know too many academics in our lives who remain, as the term used to be, armchair.
Yes.
Activists of one sort or another. But that was never David, and it is something to have known him, and a great honor to have been one of his students at a period of time. I should also mention, because I'm not sure it does come through on the little video or tape segment that we have, that David was also, along with David Brody and Herbert Gutman, known for creating something known as the New Labor History. And what that meant was that in the old days, before the 70s, let's say, labor history was confined largely to recording the rise and fall of the institutions of unions. What David did was, along with these others, and very much influenced also by some very famous English labor historians, including E.P. Thompson, was to expand the reach of labor history. So it looked at culture. We read a lot of poetry, for example, working class poetry. We saw how Walt Whitman, in fact, had a lot to say about working people when we would take a seminar with David. But also, and this was perhaps his most unique contribution, David looked at the work process itself and how does how work is organized influence how workers think, as well as how work was organized, how was it influenced by workers themselves. He always looked at working people not as passive victims, but as agents themselves who are constantly, in fact, influencing what happens to them in the workplace. And so here's to you, David. Let's hear a talk. This is a talk that David gave just a couple of years ago. Again, an activist, Historians Against the War.
Next is David Montgomery. He is Farnham Professor of History Emeritus at Yale University and past president of the Organization of American Historians. He worked for 10 years as a machinist in New York and the Twin Cities and was an active member of IAM, UE, and the Teamsters during those years. He is the author of many books, including The Fall of the House of Labor, The Workplace, the State, and American Labor Activism, 1865 to 1825. Citizen Worker, The Experience of Workers in the U.S. with Democracy and the Free Market During the 19th Century. Workers' Control in America, Studies in the History of Work, Technology, and Labor Struggles, and Beyond Equality, Labor and the Radical Republicans, 1862 to 1872. His latest book is Black Workers' Struggle for Equality in Birmingham, written in conjunction with Professor Horace Huntley of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. David?
Thank you very much, Margaret. Thank you, Alice, for covering so much of what I wanted to say. So this spares all of you, I think, a little bit of Montgomeryism in this particular session. But I do want to repeat a basic point. There's no question but that the Obama election opened up enormous hopes among the people of this country. Hopes for exactly what is often hard to say. And that's what we've got to have a hand in defining over the course of the years to come. But hopes, yes, hopes evident in the appearance of the first sit-down strike in a long time. No sooner is he elected than wham, workers in Chicago occupy the factory and the police do not throw them out. Obama says they were right, and they win the demands that were there. The only thing wrong with that whole struggle was the press report, which said there have been no sit-down strikes in America since the 1930s. I was in one in Brooklyn, New York, in 1953, American safety razor. Same union, though, so that's maybe what pulls them all together in this struggle. But the fact of the matter is, that these hopes have opened up. The victory of the workers of Smithfield Ham in winning after 15 years of struggle, first of all fought by the Latino workers, devastated by immigration service raids. Then the hopes were taken over by African-American workers until the NLRB actually issued a few good rulings, reinstating a couple of the Latinos. And suddenly there was a united front of the two groups that made for this new hope in a new atmosphere that was there. This sense, then, that something can be done by popular action, even in my new neighboring city of Philadelphia, something that seems far removed from the wars, a decree of the government to close 11 library branches. And suddenly there's been a massive turnout of the population, everybody from local African-American inhabitants to anarchists to anyone in between, all joining forces to say, our children deserve some libraries. This kind of mobilization from below is something I think we're going to see an enormous amount more of in the years to come. It doesn't by itself define what the government is doing, because when we think of the basic characteristics of this Bush-Cheney administration that Alice Kessler Harris has outlined for you so neatly, the promise of 1,000 years of war, to use a phrase that Bush used one time, war to save civilization, namely us versus terror. The promise, then, of free markets, and indeed not only the notion that if markets are somehow left untouched, all will always work for the best, leaving always aside just how free are these markets he's talking about. Are they at all like, let's say, the markets of an Arab bazaar, where people sit down individually and hassle over prices? When was the last time you did that with something that you were buying in a marketplace? Oh, clearly this is free corporate enterprise, is what has been covered by this slogan of the beauty, the infallibility of market decisions. A third element, which I think deserves mention in this, however, is a new power of the administrative state. Powers taken on by agencies above and beyond the law. No place, I think, is this clear, though it's clear in the whole bumbling Homeland Security Administration. But clear is most of all in the Department of Labor, which for the first time in its history has been run by somebody explicitly and openly hostile to labor unions, Secretary Chao, and who has used her office to virtually shut down Safety and Health Administration, to shut down even the seemingly impregnable mine inspection, because mining companies generally liked government mine inspections. But the government now has cut that out, and we're beginning to see the disasters reappearing around the land. Putting 1,000 new people to work in the Department of Labor, checking the books of every local union in the United States, while removing all the regulations that were on employers in the United States. This kind of new power being issued by administrative decree, I think, is an essential part of this link of the promise of war and of the free market, so-called. On the war promise, and all the three of those, however, those of us here, especially historians, this is supposed to be our profession, always have to ask ourselves just what's new. After all, there are long precedents for much of what the Bush and Cheney administration have been doing, and sorting out what was building up since World War II with what new level of horror has come with the Bush-Cheney administration, I think is an extremely important part for us to play. Take, for example, the glorification of free markets. The whole administration over the world of the International Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, has all been devoted to the forcing the privatization of industry and the turning over of all resources to foreign investments, creating local economies into export economies, export of goods, and perhaps unintentionally, export of people on a massive scale around the world. This is all there, after all. NAFTA stands out very much in our minds, but we think of how the whole economy of Mexico was privatized in preparation for Mexico, for NAFTA. NAFTA simply signed on the dotted line of what was done. And this is now evident in the great strike in Cananea Mines. Mexican historians among you? The very name Cananea should have you up. This is where the revolutionary struggle began in 1906. And now the workers have been out on strike for 2 years against a new private owner that has been introduced into those pits. Here, then, is the question that we must face, first of all, on the war program. The phrase that Rumsfeld came up with, shock and awe, I think stands out as the crucial thing. That we see ourselves holding, Rumsfeld, after all, never wanted to increase the infantry very much. But he always wanted to have power to bomb, and bomb anything into oblivion. A doctrine that is being repeated right before our eyes, of course, in the Gaza Strip today. But here was the notion, then, that we could single-handedly bend anyone to the will of the United States. And in the marketplace, we've seen emerge, I think, not only this absolute glorification of private ownership. Again, not entirely new. It was Margaret Thatcher who first came up with the idea that if you put in private ownership of homes, you will destroy socialism in the Labour Party in England. So here, again, this idea is taken over to the United States, but turned into a form of mobilizing absolutely speculative runaway capitalism, running away with such disastrous results that even Albert Greenspan has confessed his errors. The notion that you see people from big banking corporations now today say, we went too far, means that the question is, how far back do you go and what comes in their place? These are the new innovations, a new level of scale, and indeed a qualitatively new ideal that U.S. alone could control and dominate the globe with its power to destroy. The question then is that we have taken up here in Historians Against the War is, first of all, how to end the war in Iraq and the many wars that have come around it. And certainly our campaigning had a great deal to do with the large-scale mobilization that made Obama place ending the war in Iraq at the center of the few things that he talked about explicitly in his campaign programs. But it also has meant that these great hopes that emerged out of the fall of 2008, along with the economic crisis and ever-growing numbers of unemployed, have left us the task then of not only building on these hopes among the American people to try and redefine the promise and perils of the world in which we find ourselves, but also mobilize to see to it that Obama keeps these promises and indeed to help define them more explicitly. The question of health care that Alice Kessler-Harris talked about is right up at the top of the agenda. But right behind it, the question of, we have a new Secretary of Labor, friendly to immigrants of all things. Friendly to immigrants throughout the country, and indeed friendly to reconstructing the kind of Labor Department policies that Madam Perkins once stood for. But even the New York Times asked the question, how much support will she get from Obama? Because he surrounded himself with people from the major banks who say the worst thing we can do in a crisis is to disturb workplace relations. All right, clearly our role as a public is going to be crucial in helping to define the answers to these questions. What do we mean by bailed out? Who gets bailed out and under what terms? Do we do it by reducing everybody's living standard, as was done in the General Motors bailout? Or do we do it by building up purchasing power so that we can pull ourselves out of this long-term crisis? This means that a major task before all of us now is not only to keep open, but to broaden the discussion of not only what kind of a world we want to get rid of, the one that Bush and Cheney have given us, but what kind of a world we want to create. And as we think about this, as many ideas on that as there are people here. All right, let's get together and exchange them and see what kind of joint activities we come up with. I think of the cartoon in the New Times, the paper of the Chicago Federation of Labor in 1919, with a door that says, Versailles Conference. And outside of it are a bunch of workers banging on the door. They say, you couldn't make war without us. You can't make peace without us. That should be our slogan.
Okay, Pat, you want to talk a little more about David Montgomery? That was where that was done, or any of your own personal experiences?
Well, again, I think I did mention some of my own personal experiences with David. One of the things we were talking about as we were playing that in the booth here is something that you couldn't really see, and that's how dramatic David was. I once asked him if he had ever taken acting lessons because he was so effective in bringing students in, not just in terms of the content of what he was saying, but the way that he said it. And if I have any powers as a teacher over the years in a classroom, I also credit David for the modeling he did for me on that score. He will be missed by many, many people, and we only hope that we'll have a new generation of labor historians, and we do have some very good people, some people in this town even, who remain both academics as well as activists like him.
Okay, well, you've been listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio in Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and worldwide, webcast worldwide at weft.org. So stay tuned to Occupy Champaign-Urbana Radio. And Bill Gorell wanted to leave us with a Sedgway song here. Bill, who's this artist? And
This is Robin Ford performing Politician, the old Cream song, written by Jack Bruce, and Eric Clapton.
Okay, very good. So, again, this has been the Illinois World Labor Hour on WFT Radio, Champaign, Illinois. So tune in again next week. And in the meantime, be safe and power the people.
Hey now, baby, get into my big black car. Hey now, baby, get into my big black car. I just wanna show you just what my politics are. I'm a politician.
give a whole new meaning to the word antitrust. And you say you don't know what our demands are. And then you got the boom, and then we got the bust. And you say you don't know.